Well, it's good to see all of you, and thank you for having me. Hopefully for the next 30 minutes or so, you'll get something out of this and you'll consider it beneficial. But thank you again just for having me and giving me the opportunity to speak. About a year and a half ago, I started thinking about this. And to put you in the setting, in the context, I had picked up two studies with two different men. I'm just going to refer to them as the taller one and the shorter one to protect their identities. But I picked them up through a mutual friend at Gardendale, and they were interested in studying. They both lived in the Hoover area, and we had worked something out where they were going to drive up to Gardendale once a week, and then the other weeks I would drive down to Oak Mountain, and Bob Hutto let us use their building there to meet there. And so I had gotten this great study with these two guys. Let me describe to you the way these two guys were. The taller one was really the one I was really targeting, and I really had every indication in thinking that he was going to obey the gospel. And I remember even telling Jason, my coworker, one day, like, yeah, the taller one, he's definitely going to obey the gospel. There's not a doubt in my mind. And it's because how religious he was and how devout he was. He knew where the Bible, knew what the Bible was. He knew the general story. There was a lot of things I got to skip because he already understood those things. And I was just really trying to hit him with what it took to obey the gospel. Now, he brought his best friend with him that he's known since he was a little kid. And his best friend is the one I'm calling the shorter one. The shorter one, I really didn't have any expectation that he was going to obey the gospel. He wasn't very religious. He really had no understanding of God at all. I even remember the first day we met, you know, he didn't even have a Bible. So we brought him a Bible and made sure he had a Bible. I remember when I told him, hey, let's look at this passage in Mark chapter 1. And he couldn't find it. So we would help him and we would help him find it and that sort of thing. He didn't have a consistent job. He kind of worked everywhere. There's really nothing in his life that was actually consistent in the first place. And getting to know him and spending time with him and studying with him, I just did not have any kind of expectation that he was going to keep on studying with us. I thought eventually he would drop out. I remember one day specifically that we were going over something that Jesus did interesting to Mark. And he got so excited about it, he slapped the table and he just like dropped this curse word. And, you know, you think for a moment, you know, a guy who's gotten so excited about a story he's never heard before and he just starts cursing about it. You know, you really wonder about what your expectations are. Now, a year later, in hindsight, do you know which ones obeyed the gospel? It's my shorter one, my shorter friend. My taller friend, once we got to baptism and we got to what it took to obey the gospel, he was just already so confident in the place where he was and his understanding of the gospel that he really just didn't have any interest in it. But my shorter friend, or his shorter friend, was very interested when we got to the point about what it took to obey the gospel. And now the shorter friend is a member at Gardendale, and he's been a member there for a year now. And he's married one of the sisters there. You know, and he studies with me weekly, and he's become one of my favorite studies. You know, the same time that this is going on last year, I'm also writing Matthew material. And what I come to find out, in my own little personal revelation, is that Matthew tried to warn me about this. Have you ever been disappointed with a study where you had every expectation that this person that you had kind of been targeting and studying with, that they were going to obey the gospel, and then they disappointed you? Have you ever been completely surprised and shocked where there was someone that you were not trying to necessarily target, but someone who you were studying with, and they were the ones who ended up obeying the gospel? You see, it brings me to the question, who does the kingdom choose? Because the kingdom obviously chose this younger one because he chose the kingdom, or the shorter friend. But the taller friend, evidently, the kingdom did not choose because he didn't choose the kingdom. And I just want to go through some text in Matthew and show you who the kingdom chooses and how that's different than maybe what we necessarily think the kingdom chooses. So we're going to be looking at several parables. Let's start in Matthew 22 in verse 1. This is the parable of the wedding feast, and Jesus says the kingdom is like a king sending out invites to his son's wedding feast. It says in verse 1, and Jesus answered and spoke to them again by parables and said, the kingdom of heaven is like a certain king who arranged a marriage for his son and sent out his servants to call those who were invited to the wedding, and they were not willing to come. Again, he sent out other servants, saying, tell them who are invited, see, I have prepared my dinner, my oxen and my fatted cattle are killed, and all things are ready, come to the wedding. But they made light of it and went their ways, one to his own farm, another to his business. And the rest seized his servants, treated them spitefully, and killed them. But when the king heard about it, he was furious. And he sent out his armies, destroyed the murderers, and burned up their city. Then he said to his servants, "The wedding is ready, but those who are invited were not worthy. Therefore go into the highways, and as many as you can find, invite them to the wedding." So the servants went into the highways and gathered together all who they found, both bad and good, and the wedding hall was filled with guests. But when the king came to see the guests, he saw a man there who did not have on a wedding garment. So he said to him, "Friend, how did you come in here without a wedding garment?" And he was speechless. Then the king said to the servants, "Bind him hand and foot, take him away, and cast him into outer darkness. There will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. For many are called, but few are chosen." And Jesus almost ends all of his parables in this section with, "But many are called, but few are chosen." Let's break that down and just show the kingdom parallel with this one. I know you warned me and I pressed the wrong button instead. What we see here, being that the wedding feast is the kingdom, and people are being invited to the kingdom, and we see who actually shows up to the kingdom. Jesus here right off the bat shows us the people the kingdom calls, but the kingdom does not choose. And don't get caught up on the word "choose" there with Jesus. All he means by that is the people that were the chosen were the people who actually end up entering the kingdom. That's all it is. The kingdom invites everyone to enter it, but only those that it chooses are the ones who actually enter it. We learn very early that the kingdom does not necessarily choose the good. You look there in verse 10, the people who actually are chosen and come to the kingdom. Look at that. So the servants went out into the highways and gathered together all that they found, both bad and good. And the wedding hall was filled with guests. Does the kingdom necessarily choose the good? All the good people in the world, they're the ones that are going to come and obey the gospel. Right here Jesus says, not necessarily. Now, going along with that, what about the bad? The bad are not also necessarily chosen to come and join the kingdom. That even if you're a bad person, not just you're a good person, but even if you're a bad person, that's not necessarily the people who the kingdom chooses to come and enter the kingdom. We also see that not necessarily the religious are the ones that are called and come and join the kingdom. I get that not necessarily from 22, but I infer it because of what was said in chapter 21. You look back to verse chapter 21 and verse 43, we get the context of where the kingdom feast parable is sitting in. Jesus had just told the parable of the landowners, and in verse 43, Jesus says this. He says, "Therefore I say to you, the kingdom of God will be taken from you and given to a nation bearing fruits of it. And whoever falls on the stone will be broken, but whoever it falls, it will grind him into powder." If we just stop right there, who is verse 43 talking about? He's talking about the Jewish kingdom, the kingdom of Israel. He says the gospel, the kingdom, will be taken away from the Jews and it will be given to nations that are more deserving of it. Obviously, Jesus here talking about the coming Gentiles being offered to be able to be chosen in the kingdom. But he's telling the Jews, it's going to be taken away from you because you're not willing to hear it. But look at verse 45. After talking about the stumbling stone that they're going to be ground up on, it says, "Now the chief priests and the Pharisees heard his parable, and they perceived that he was speaking of them. And when they sought to lay hands on him, they feared the multitude because they took him for a prophet." And then Jesus goes on to tell the parable of the wedding feast. You know, who were the people that the king first invited to come and be part of the wedding feast? Who are the first group of people that God invited to come and be part of his kingdom? It was the religious of the day. But did the Pharisees and the chief priests and the Sadducees, did they just jump on board with the kingdom and they accepted those invites? No, what did they do? They killed the son, right? The kingdom called them, but the religious, not necessarily, were chosen. Now, this goes to say the other side as well. I did it again. Not just the religious, but also the non-religious. The non-religious weren't necessarily chosen as well to come and be part of the kingdom. You look at 22 verse 5 again. It says that there was a group of people that when they were invited, it said that they made light of it. And they went to their ways, one to his own farm, another to his own business. Have you tried to talk to people about the gospel and they responded in the same way you have here in verse 5? Now, they could have been religious, but in my examples that I can think of in my own life, usually those people were non-religious. Frankly, they were in a situation where they just didn't really care. They had no concern about spiritual things, nor did they want to hear about spiritual things. They were more interested on getting to work or getting back home or doing whatever they needed to do that day. They just kind of made light of it. So I think this as well, the non-religious aren't necessarily all the ones that are chosen to come and join the kingdom. What about those that attack messengers in verse 6? They were invited by these messengers and they treated them spitefully and they killed them. Were they chosen to be part of the kingdom? They never even heard the message in the first place. No, they weren't chosen to come and be part of the kingdom. In fact, the king was so furious that his messengers were killed that he went out there and he made sure they were put to death. The king enacted on this. These people weren't necessarily chosen. And one more here. There was one there who was not willing to put on his wedding garment. So he bothered to come. He bothered to show up. But he wasn't willing to put on a wedding garment. And what was the end result to him in verse 11? Well, it says there that he was cast into hell because of his unwillingness to put on his wedding garment. What's the parallel there to our spiritual world that we live in? I don't think Jesus is saying that we have to wear the special type of clothing to come and enter the kingdom. Well, every time we talk about clothing in terms of Christ in the New Testament, what are we usually talking about? Put off your old self and put on Jesus Christ, right? Be clothed in His righteousness. You read the Revelation, what is Jesus there doing with the white robes? He's given the white robes out to the sanctified. Can I suggest to you that the clothing here, the wedding garment, is the salvation we find in Jesus Christ? Willing to accept the salvation that comes into Jesus Christ. Willing to, as we would say, obey the gospel. That's the person who was willing to put on this wedding garment. This person was present, he bothered to show up, but he wasn't willing to obey the gospel. And therefore, he was cast into hell. Then he says here at the end, of course, that all were called. All of those that hear the invite are called to be part of the kingdom. But did the kingdom choose everybody? Did all those people end up in the kingdom? No, they didn't, because they were concerned with other things. So just here off at the very beginning, we can see who the kingdom does not specifically choose. Now, maybe you can put yourself in the shoes here of these invitees. When you go and you look for people to study the gospel with, who are the type of people that you're usually targeting? I'll use myself as an example. Andrew Smith is usually targeting people that are good and people that are religious. And maybe to the fault of my own, those are the people that I primarily maybe work the hardest to try to pick up studies with. And I tell myself, well, they're already very good. They already really have some type of love for the Lord. Certainly these people would be the ones that would come and obey the gospel and enter the kingdom. And yet, like with my taller friend, I was disappointed. Thinking about Matthew, with this individual right here, a good and religious person, can you think about somebody in Matthew that we just described? Can you think about somebody that Jesus spoke to in Matthew that was a good man and even a religious man, and yet the kingdom did not choose him? I think we just described the rich young ruler. Turn backwards to Matthew chapter 19. In Matthew chapter 19, Jesus gives his law of marriage, and he even ends there with the thought that those who are willing to submit to his marriage law are those who can enter the kingdom. And then, immediately after, we have the story of whom we call the rich young ruler. Look at verse 16 there, and let's read that section. It says, "Now behold, one came and said to him, 'Good teacher, what good thing shall I do that I may have eternal life?' So he said to me, 'Why do you call me good? No one is good but one, that is God. But if you want to enter into life, keep the commandments.' And he said to him, 'Which ones?' And Jesus said, 'You shall not murder, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not steal, you shall not bear false witness, honor your father and mother, and you shall love your neighbor as yourself.' And the young man said to him, 'All these things I have kept from my youth, what do I still lack?' And Jesus said to him, 'If you want to be perfect, go sell and what you have and give to the poor, and you will have treasure in heaven, and come, follow me. But when the young man heard this saying, he went away sorrowful, for he had great possessions. And we could continue on the thought, but I just want to take that much right now. You have this young man who's obviously wealthy, obviously in other hands, he's some type of ruler. And he comes to Jesus, and he asks him a very good question. What good thing shall I do that I may have eternal life? What a great question. And Jesus gives him a great answer. He says, if you want to enter into life, well then keep the commandments. What should have the rich young ruler said right there? Should he have not said, yes, sir? Was that not a satisfactory answer? You want to enter life? Well, keep God's commandments. He could have said, well said. And then Jesus said, come follow me. And he could have followed Jesus. And that could have been the end of the story. But the rich young man continues to press Jesus for a more specific answer. So he asks Jesus again. He says, which ones? What do you mean, which ones? You know, that's the way I kind of think of it in hindsight. But again, Jesus gives him a good answer. He lists, you know, hey, you know, don't murder. Should not commit adultery. Should not steal. Honor your father and mother. Love your neighbor as yourself. You know, those commandments. What should the rich young ruler said right then? He should have said, yes, sir. Those are the commandments. Jesus could have said, come follow me, and he could have come and followed Jesus. But is the rich young ruler satisfied? No, he presses Jesus again. And imagine the arrogance in this statement right here. You know, imagine the arrogance if someone said this to you in real life. All these things I have kept from my youth. What do I still lack? Who in the world says something like that? I've been doing this since I was a little boy. And then not only that, but say it to Jesus. Can I suggest to you that the rich young ruler here was not looking for help, but instead he was looking for reassurance? That he was not coming to Jesus because he needed help. He was not coming to Jesus because he really wanted to know what he needed to do so he could receive eternal life. What was the rich young ruler looking for? Y'all, he was looking for a pat on the back. He was looking for Jesus to say, well done. He was looking for a way he'd go back to his buddies and say, Jesus gave me a thumbs up. The rich young ruler was not looking for help. He was looking for reassurance. And that's why the kingdom did not choose him. He wasn't looking for change. He wasn't looking for anything. Finally, Jesus gives him something he knows he won't do, which is go sell what you have and then come and follow me. And he knows the rich young ruler won't do that. And he doesn't. And now the kingdom has called this young man, but he has not chosen him. In hindsight, he did not come to Jesus for help. If he had come for help, what would he have done? Well, wouldn't he have submitted to Jesus' command? When someone really needs help, and they're in dire need of help, when someone says, this is what you can do to help yourself, what do they usually end up doing? They do the thing they need to do to receive the help. But he doesn't do it. He doesn't submit to Jesus' command because he's not really looking for help. Therefore, the kingdom called this young man, but it did not choose him. And what's funny about us, I think, especially for myself, I usually end up targeting rich and young rulers, and then I'm shocked when they don't obey the gospel. But these people aren't looking for help. They're looking for reassurance. And I'm still going to call them with the help of the Lord. The Lord's still going to call them with the way that He works. But don't be shocked when they don't enter the kingdom, because they're not looking for the kingdom. Now, let's answer the question finally, but who does the kingdom choose? We've talked about everybody the kingdom doesn't choose, but who does the kingdom choose? And I think we can answer this again with another parable in Matthew. Look now in chapter 21. If you have a hard time turning pages in a sermon, today should be very easy. Matthew 21, verse 28. This is the parable of the two sons in the vineyard. Jesus says, but what do you think? A man had two sons, and he came the first and said, son, go work today in my vineyard. He answered and said, I will not. But afterward he regretted and went. Then he came to the second son and said likewise. And he answered and said, I go, sir. But he did not go. Which one of these two did the will of his father? They said to him, the first. Jesus said to them, surely I say to you, that tax collectors and harlots enter the kingdom of God before you. For John came to you in the way of righteousness, but you did not believe him. But tax collectors and harlots believed him. And when you saw it, you did not afterward relent and believe him." The parable is just simply two sons. The father tells the same two sons to do the same thing. The first son says he wasn't going to go, but later he's regretful. And so he goes ahead and he does what the father asked him to do because of his regret. The first son has no regret. He says, "Of course I'll go do that," but he just doesn't ever do it. He asks the question, which one does the will of the father? Well, it's the one that regretted and was willing to submit to the command of the father. Who does the kingdom choose? The kingdom chooses the regretful that are willing to submit to Jesus. That's who the kingdom chooses. That type of person will obey the gospel every time. What it is here is someone who's in a state where they are in so need of help, and they believe that Jesus can give them that help. So what are they going to do? They're going to submit to whatever Jesus tells them to do. That's the type of person that the kingdom chooses. And to ask Jesus' question, to ask a question about Jesus' statement, Jesus says to them in verse 31, "Assuredly I say to you that the tax collectors and the harlots enter the kingdom before you." Why? Why is that the case? I know some of us have been hearing this sentence our whole lives, that the tax collectors and the harlots enter the kingdom before the Pharisees. But why is that the case? I think the answer is the same answer as to who does the kingdom choose. And let me propose to you that the answer is that the kingdom chooses the broken. That's who the kingdom chooses. It's the people that are broken, and they know they're broken, and they're willing to do something about their brokenness. That's who the kingdom chooses. Does the kingdom choose the man who is broken, but he's not willing ever to admit it? No, that person will never go to the Lord looking for help. What about the person that really has no concept of their brokenness? They're satisfied with their life. They're satisfied with their career. They're satisfied where they're going to be in the next 5 years. They have no concern about anything else except their own personal satisfaction. Is that person going to become broken and come before the Father? No. The kingdom chooses the broken. And that's what I see here from Matthew. Two quick thoughts about this. Where could you go to get a good definition of what the broken look like? What about the beginning of the Sermon on the Mount? "Blessed are the poor in spirit. Blessed are those who mourn. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake. Blessed are these broken people. Blessed are these broken people. Blessed are these broken people." Why does Jesus start that off with the Sermon on the Mount? He describes the type of people that his kingdom chooses. The people that are broken and are willing to admit they're broken and willing to submit to the Lord about their brokenness. That's the type of people the kingdom chooses. The second observation I want to make about this: have you noticed we've stayed in Matthew this whole time? I think there's a need sometimes to go through the Gospels and we cover all four at once. I call that the Waldron method. I know that Bob Waldron, there's more people than Bob Waldron that just do that. But you know, Waldron handled the Gospels like a historian. When he wrote his class material, he handled it like a historian. And you take all four of the Gospels and you pit the story all together from all four of those Gospels. I think that's something we need to do. But there's also a need sometimes to go read Matthew and study Matthew just for the message of Matthew. And go study Mark just for the study of Mark, and study Luke for just the study of Luke. Why? Because these men, especially the Apostle Matthew here, they have their own message. And Matthew is using the teachings of Jesus and the events of Jesus, and he's ordering them in such a manner that when his readers hear it, they hear a sermon from Matthew's mouth. Why would Matthew here in this section of Matthew be teaching that the broken are whom the kingdom has chosen? Why would Matthew record a thought that harlots and tax collectors would enter the kingdom before the Pharisees? Is this not Matthew, the old tax collector? And what is his sermon about? His sermon is about tax collectors like him the kingdom chooses. What an appeal to us. that like Matthew, I can go toward the king and submit to his will in my brokenness. And Matthew the Apostle teaches that through the events that he records here in Matthew. So, now that we've understood that, let's talk about who the kingdom can choose. What if we had someone, you know, maybe like my shorter brother now, or maybe the opposite of the rich young ruler. What if we had someone who was bad, mean, cruel, and they were completely non-religious and they didn't have any care for the Lord, and maybe even they attacked messengers previously. They attacked other Bible teachers or preachers previously and they were really rude to them, but then all of a sudden one day they were willing to come and submit and put on their wedding garment. Would they be chosen by the kingdom? Yes, they would. The kingdom would choose this person, right? What about another person? What about if we actually did have a rich young ruler person and he was good, very morally able. And also he was very religious and very devout in the things that he believed in. And he too one day decided to come and submit to Jesus and put on his wedding garment. Would the kingdom choose him? Yes, he would. Because what I see here is it doesn't matter about who you used to be. All that matters is what you're willing to do today. Are you willing to come and be broken before the Father and submit to Jesus Christ? That's the only question. Those are the type of the people whom the kingdom chooses, is the people that are willing to submit. Now, just to put in hindsight here again. Back with my two friends at the very beginning, I was shocked that my taller friend did not want to enter the kingdom. And I was surprised that my shorter friend did want to enter the kingdom. I had shared that with some people at Gardendale. And I wasn't amazed. I kind of expected it. But several came to me and started sharing me their own experiences with how they had been studying with their loved ones especially. And they too were so disappointed that they had these good, lovely people that they truly, really loved. And they even were sincere about their care for the Lord, and yet they would refuse to obey the gospel. And they were very disheartened about that. One lady said to me specifically, and I thought this was gold in her observation. She said, "Andrew, I have to watch my bitterness. That I have people in my family that I love and adore and admire that are the kindest, sweetest people in the world, and they refuse to obey the gospel, and I have to tell myself that they do not have salvation. But on the other hand, sometimes I'm around my brothers and sisters in Christ whom I know have salvation, and sometimes they're mean and rude and dirty and broken." She said, "Why in the world would God save these people, these rude brethren of mine, but he won't extend salvation to my loved one over here who's kind and sweet as can be? How is that fair?" I think Jesus knew we were going to ask that question. Why in the world do we have brothers and sisters that are obviously not there, and yet I have good moral friends and loved ones out there who refuse to obey the gospel, and yet they are good people? How is that fair? Well, thankfully, Jesus provided us with another parable. Ready? Chapter 20, verse 1. Let's see here what really is fair. Chapter 20, verse 1. Says, "For the kingdom of heaven is like a landowner who went out early in the morning to hire laborers for his vineyard. And when he agreed with the laborers for a denarius a day, who sent them into his vineyard. And he went out about the third hour and saw others standing idle in the marketplace. And said to them, 'You also go into the vineyard. And whatever is right, I will give you.' So they went. Again, he went out about the sixth and the ninth hour and did likewise. And about the 11th hour, he went out, found others standing idle. And he said to them, 'What have you been standing here idle all day?' They said to him, 'Because no one has hired us.' He said to them, 'You also go into the vineyard, and whatever is right, you will receive.' And an evening had come. The owner of the vineyard said to his steward, 'Call the laborers and give them their wages, beginning with the last to the first.' And when they came who were hired about the 11th hour, they each received a denarius. But when the first came, they supposed that they would receive more, and they likewise received each a denarius. And when they had received it, they complained against the landowner, saying, these last men have worked only 1 hour, and you made them equal to us who have borne the burden in the heat of the day. But he answered to one of them and said, friend, I am doing you no wrong. Did you not agree with me for a denarius? Take what is yours and go your way. I wish to give to this last man the same as to you. And this is key. Is it not lawful for me to do what I wish with my own things, or is your eye evil because I am good? So the last will be first, and the first last, for many are called, but few are chosen. The landowner here, if you didn't catch it, goes out and he hires people at dawn, and they agree on that he's going to pay them a denarius, a day's wage for the whole day's work. But every couple of hours, the landowner goes back out into town, and he picks up more laborers. Eventually, it's the 11th hour. I mean, they only got 1 hour of daylight left. And he hires some people to come and work just 1 hour in the vineyard. He pays them then from the least amount of work to the most amount of work. And what does he do? He gives them all the same payment. He gives them all a denarius. So the people who work longer come to the landowner and say, this isn't fair. This guy over here has only worked 1 hour. I've worked 11 hours, and we're getting paid the same? Is that fair? Before I answer Jesus' answer, or before I give Jesus' answer, can y'all put that today in a modern setting? You know, maybe y'all see on the news about Bessemer and the Amazon, you know, corporation over there, and what they're doing with their laborers. You can read about it on the news, whatever. If something like that happened at the Amazon location, where these guys only worked 1 hour and these other guys worked 11 hours, and there was the same payment given, what would there be? There'd be a lawsuit. And a lot of us, we would say, rightly so, there would be a lawsuit. That isn't fair. And I'm not talking about fair in terms of righteousness. I'm talking about fair in terms of deserving what you get. That isn't fair. But look at Jesus' answer in verse 15. Is it not lawful for me to do what I wish with my own things? The Andrew Smith version is this. Jesus says, I'm Jesus, I do what I want. And if I want to pay you and reward you for 11 hours of work, I will. And if I want to pay you for 1 hour's worth of work, I will. Jesus is saying, if I want to give salvation to this person who's been a Christian their entire life, I will. If I want to give salvation to someone who was a Christian on the last hour of their life, you know what? I will. And Jesus says there's nothing we can say about it because he's Jesus and he gets to do what he wants with his things, which is the power of his blood and grace. It's not fair. But Jesus gets to do what he wants. And if he wants to extend salvation to my shorter friend, who really had no interest in God before he started cracking open a Bible, Jesus can do that. And if Jesus wants to reject salvation to my taller friend who refuses to submit to him, Jesus can do that. Because he's Jesus. But also, the more I think about it, do I really want Jesus to be fair? Do I want Jesus to treat me and pay me fairly? Y'all, I don't want Jesus to treat me fair. I want Jesus to treat me with grace and mercy, which is not fair. What would have been fair was for me to go to hell. What would be fair would be for all my brothers and sisters to go to hell. But Jesus didn't give us fair. He gave us mercy. It's actually to my benefit that Jesus, in this sense, is not fair. Now, I know we can talk about fair in terms of righteousness, and of course God is fair. But I'm talking about sense of wages. It's to my benefit that God goes beyond fair. God's good. And that's why I have brothers and sisters that are weak and have only been here for an hour, and they're in a saved state, when I've got good, kindly, nice, sweet people out here that refuse to submit to Jesus, and they don't have salvation. God isn't trying to give wages here. God's extending mercy. And to the people that are willing to submit to him, whoever they are, he will extend mercy to them, whoever will submit. So let me wrap this up in a nice little bow. Why does the kingdom choose the broken? And I think there's some good observations we can make about this. The first one is, the king chooses the broken to save because they are the ones that will admit that they need him. Right? They're the ones that will actually say, no, I need the Lord. I'm nothing without the Lord. The Lord is the one who's repaired my brokenness. We could go to 1 Corinthians 1, where Paul makes the same point. You know, he says, look around the room. Not many noble or not many mighty are in that room with you. Not members of the church with you. But let me instead go to Matthew chapter 11. Jesus says something similar in verse 25 when he's given a prayer to the Father. It says, and at that time Jesus said, I thank you, Father, Lord of heaven and earth, that you have hidden these things from the wise and prudent have revealed them to babes. Even so, Father, for so it seemed good in your sight. It is good in the Father's sight not to reveal the gospel to the wise and the prideful and the mighty, but it was good in the Father's sight to reveal the gospel to the weak and to the babes. And Jesus not only endorses it here, but he thanks the Father for setting it up like that. Why would Jesus thank the Father for setting it up like that? Is it not that Jesus wants to spend eternity with his friends? You know, is it not that Jesus wants to spend eternity and reward those that are willing to humbly submit to him? Is that not who you would rather spend eternity with? Would you rather spend eternity with the humble or the prideful? I think we would all agree that we would rather spend eternity with the humble. Those that all that are willing to admit freely that they need Jesus. The second one, why does the king choose the broken? Well, they're the ones that will obey him. That should be kind of easy to understand. The rich young ruler refused to obey Jesus because he didn't think he needed him. But those who thought they needed Jesus and believed they needed Jesus, like Matthew, they did come and obey him. Bob Hutto gave me this line when we were studying together at the Oak Mountain Building with the two friends. And he said, in this analogy, he said, think of the 10 most humble people you know. And you can come up with that on your own in your own mind. I'd like to think maybe you could put me in that group, but that's your own decision. The 10 most humble people you can think about. You go and you take them into a dirty, filthy room. And you say, hey, here's a mop. Here's a bucket. Will you please clean this room? And you leave them for an hour. Then, go get the 10 most prideful people you can think of. The 10 most arrogant people you can think of. And go take them to a similar room. Say, here's the mop. Here's the bucket. Will you please clean this room? When you come back in an hour, which room's going to be clean? Well, the 10 humble people, they're going to be the ones who have cleaned the room. Because they're humble people and they're just going to do what was asked of them. But what would the prideful people do in all hour? Well, they were sitting there and they were debating on why they should have to clean this room in the first place. And they were trying to come up with logical arguments as why they could disobey your request. Why would Jesus want to only call the humble? Because he knows we're the ones that are actually going to do what he asked us to do. Jesus has a mission. He has a plan. He wants a team that will obey him. And the arrogant and the prideful, they won't obey him. But the broken and the humble, we will jump to obey him, won't we? And that's why the kingdom is better off with the broken. And finally, one more. The kingdom chooses the broken because they demonstrate his strength through their weakness. We could go to 1 Corinthians again. We could go to Gideon's story. Let me take you to a different example of this in a negative sense. It's become one of my favorites. In 2 Samuel 5, you don't have to turn there unless you want to. David and Joab are about to take the city of Jerusalem for the first time. And as they go up there, it's almost like the Jebusites are going to yell down from their castle, and they're going to yell something at David. And this is what we get there in verse 6 of 2 Samuel 5. It says, and the king and his men went to Jerusalem against the Jebusites, the inhabitants of the land who spoke to David, saying, you shall not come in here, but the blind and the lame will repel you, thinking David cannot come in here. Why was that an insult to David? The Jebusites yelling down, David, our lame and our blind will be the ones that will repel you. What they were saying was, is that they are so strong that their broken people will be able to overcome David's influence here. That's what the insult is, right? Even our worst will be able to overcome you. Now, in a positive sense, Jesus is fighting his war. And who does he have on his front lines? Does he not have the spiritually broken that he has perfected? Does he not have the spiritually lame and blind that he has helped? And those are the ones who've been leading the charge for 2,000 years for his mission? What does that tell Satan when Jesus beats him with the broken? I think it's a powerful statement to Satan. It shows the true manifold wisdom of God is what it does. Where Satan will have no question in his mind at the end that he was defeated. And he was defeated with the broken. With Jesus' broken. I think that's why the kingdom chooses the broken. In conclusion, my shorter friend, I'm going to have to go home and tell him I preached about him. I called him the shorter friend. He won't like that. My shorter friend obeyed the gospel. Why? Because he was willing to admit he was broken, and he was willing to come and submit to the Son. Does that mean that my taller friend will always be lost? A week ago, my taller friend called me and asked me if we could start studying again. Anybody can be broken, right? Obviously, the kingdom chooses the broken, but anybody that's of accountable age can be broken. What that is a decision that we have to make. If you're in a situation today, and you can go ahead and get out your songbooks. But if you're in a situation today where you need to submit to the Father, or you need to submit to the Son, and whether that be submission by obeying the gospel in the waters of baptism, or whether that be that there's just something that you don't practice that you know the Father wants you to submit to, maybe today, instead of considering your need to submit to the Father, maybe instead today you could consider your own brokenness. How badly do you really need the Lord's help? How badly do you really need to submit to the Father? Because I think if we can understand that, the humbling ourselves and the submitting becomes easy. Why is it easy? Because I owe Him everything. That's why it becomes easy. If we can have that type of mindset. Many are called, but few are chosen. And certainly we all here can be the chosen. If there's anyone we can spiritually assist, why don't you come forward as we stand and sing.